Okay, good afternoon, everybody. It is April 6th, Tuesday, 12:40, and we are going to do mass spec today. So let me go ahead and start a screen share. All right, screen share's up. The only thing that I don't have up is the chat window. So let me grab that. And I think everything is now in place. All right, so what I want to talk about today is I want to talk about mass spectroscopy. I have to get my words right too. Okay, in mass spec, what we're doing is we're taking a sample, and that sample is generally in some syringe. You take it and you inject it into a part of the instrument. Actually, I don't even know if I need to design it that way. We inject it into an area that takes it through what's called ionization. And usually it sprays it out, vaporizes it, and then oftentimes there are different ways in which it can be ionized. There's electron impact, there are electrospray, there's a number of different ionization techniques. So electron impact. There's electrospray. Most of the time we're going to be talking about electron impact, and that's where you actually have an electron that you send in. It hits the molecule and it knocks one of the valence electrons off the molecule. And it results in what is called a molecular ion. In electrospray, what we do is we oftentimes add protons to molecules. So what happens in electrospray is we use an acid in the spray process, in the ionization process, and it picks up that proton. And in picking up the proton, it becomes MH plus. And this is another type of molecular ion. And so there are different types of techniques depending upon what your compound looks like. And then once it goes through that ionization technique and we get the radical ion, then what it does is it travels through an area where we have a couple of magnets that are set up. And these magnets create a magnetic field that goes in a particular direction. And because of the charged nature of the particle, as it travels through the magnets, bends. And it bends and then comes down and hits a detector. And the detector works by having small little receptors that are down here that catch the ion as it hits the detector, and it registers a hit at a specific location. The location acts like a ruler, and the ruler is measuring the mass to charge ratio. And what we find is that if the mass is heavier, then the particle will not bend as much. The particle will resist the bending of the magnets. So this is large mass, is out here. And if the mass is smaller, then it'll hit farther up over here. It'll bend more. It'll be affected by the magnets more. Same thing if the charge is high. If we have a large charge, let's say instead of a plus one charge, we have a plus two charge or a plus three charge, then the higher charge will be more affected by the magnet and it will hit further up on the detector. If the charge is a single charge, then it will not be as affected by the magnet. And so really what we're looking at is the mass to charge ratio that is happening at this detector and the location where the molecule hits on that detector. And that's all mass spectroscopy is. It actually is fairly simple. It's just a matter of taking and creating a charged species, passing it through the magnetic field and seeing how the magnetic field affects it such that we can tell its mass to charge ratio. And it is extremely sensitive. So this works, mass spec. Works on samples as small as 10 to the minus 6 grams. So that you can actually do mass spectroscopy on even single molecules sometimes. They've been able to take and do synthesis on solid phase where they want to analyze the materials that are on the solid phase. And they'll do it almost like on a bar, like on the pencil, where they'll do synthesis on the solid phase. Then they'll take that and they'll wave it through an ionization laser where the laser knocks a molecule off. That molecule travels through the mass spec and then they can tell the mass of that molecule, which is really quite incredible. So the difference is, as I was saying, in electron impact and electrospray ionization. When we look at electron impact, the reason that we might use one over another for these techniques. Electron impact creates radical cations. It's good for up to 3,500 grams per mole. So if you think about most of the molecules that we deal with, when we deal with small molecules in organic chemistry, you're dealing with things that may have 200, 300, maybe up to 500 grams per mole. Most of the stuff that you're dealing with is pretty small. So to be able to go up to 3,500 grams per mole, that's a fairly large molecule that you're dealing with. Some issues with it. Sometimes the molecular ion is missing. Sometimes that doesn't show up. Poor substances or polar substances don't work as well in this. Polar substances are much better with the electrospray ionization. So electron impact, we usually abbreviate EI. The electrospray ionization this is ESI. ESI creates MH plus. It is good for 100,000 grams per mole. So what the heck are we going to do at 100,000 grams per mole? That's when you start getting up into proteins. It's really good for proteins and analyzing larger proteins. Could you shoot higher energy photons light at it instead, Keegan? Yeah, there might be ionization techniques where that's done. I'm not aware of any. Pretty much what I know. I mean, when we say higher energy photons of light, electron impact is sort of higher energy photons of light. When you're doing the electron impact, that is a photon that you're hitting that thing with, and you're knocking off an electron that's one of the valence electrons. So we're always knocking off the valence electrons. Here, some of the problems are that we often get multiply charged ions. You can get M2H, which is creating here, and M with three H's. That these things happen all the time. Because when you're doing proteins and things, there are multiple locations that can be protonated within those large molecules. When you have multiple areas that can be protonated and they do get protonated, we can create plus one, plus two, plus three, plus four cations, which changes your mass to charge ratio, which makes it a little bit harder to figure out what the actual mass of the molecule is, because you need to figure out what the charge ratio is. The other thing that doesn't happen here are that fragmentations are rare. Why are fragmentations important? Well, I'll put fragmentations up on the other one too that I didn't put in here. Fragmentations under electron impact are common. Fragmentations are where the molecule, the molecular ion, after it gets that charge on it, that ion is unstable and sometimes degrades and breaks apart, where you break apart sigma bonds and other bonds, where the molecule will fragment into additional subunits. Those subunits can be characterized, their masses can be found, the subunits can be characterized, and they can tell you about some of the functional groups within the molecule. They can tell you about some of the connectivity within the molecule. So electron impact, the fragmentation, is one of the big things that we look for in order to be able to figure out structure. And so that fragmentation is very, very helpful. The fact that we don't see very much fragmentation in electrospray ionization means that it's less helpful for figuring out connectivity, while it's still extremely helpful for figuring out the mass. So those are some of the differences between electron impact and electrospray ionization. Okay. Let me see what I've got that I wanted to show you. Maybe just two examples of a couple of electron impact reactions. Okay, when we look at electron impact, let's look at acetone. This is C3H6O. And as we look at the structure of acetone, it's generally the valence electrons that are targeted by electron impact. And so what we say is we will lose an electron that is going to come off of this. We can highlight that by the energy coming in here and knocking off the electron. So we lose the electron. This guy is going to go away. It's always one of the valence electrons that are lost. And so those valence electrons, the highest energy electrons, are always the pi bonds and lone pairs. So those are the types of electrons that we lose. What we create is we create the radical cation. So this is said to be the radical cation, or the molecular ion. That molecular ion then has a formula which is C3H6O, now with a positive charge, and it has a mass to charge ratio equal to 58. And actually, we generally don't even put the 58 grams per mole because it's a mass to charge ratio. So we usually just list it at 58, but it's 58 grams per mole when we convert it back and think about it. And the fact that we're losing an electron, remember that one electron, if we go back and we think about the mass of an electron, one electron equals 1/2000th of the mass of a proton or a neutron. And so the fact that an electron weighs 1/2000th of a proton, and that most of the time within a molecule, we're dealing with a molecule that may have 20, 30, 40 electrons, that losing an electron compared to a proton or a neutron, it changes the mass infinitesimally. So we really don't see a mass change in losing the electron off the molecule. So that mass to charge ratio is considered to be equal to the molecular weight of the molecule. And we can also look at this mass to charge ratio, and I can give it two different readings. We could say that this is low resolution, where I'm getting 2 sig figs, or some instruments have very high resolution, very high precision, 58.04187. This would be high resolution data. So the high resolution data, the ability of this thing to measure the molecular ion's mass at 58.04187 grams per mole, that many significant figures in the measurement actually allows you to go back and figure out what isotopes are within this molecule and to figure out what the actual formula of the molecule is just from the mass alone, which is really cool. And I'll show you some mass spec calculators. I'll show you how we go through and do that. Okay, so that's an example of electron impact with acetone. From acetone, let's take and look at some fragmentations, and different types of fragmentations that we see. So this is just an overview real quick, and then we'll go into application and we'll start looking at how we do everything from here. Two major types of fragmentation. One is homolytic and the other is heterolytic. So in homolytic, what happens is if we take the radical cation, we find that a bond can fragment, and homolytically, one electron goes one direction, and the other electron combines with the existing radical. That whole thing fragments, breaking the bond right down the middle, and we wind up getting an oxygen which is triply bound to a methyl group, one lone pair of electrons on it, positive charge still existing on that piece. And the other piece that comes off is the CH3 with a lone electron as a free radical. And so this would be a type of homolytic fragmentation pattern. What we end up with is we end up with a charged ion, and we end up with a free radical, a neutral free radical, I should say. Does this work for pretty much any substance with a grams per mole limit? Yes, Keegan, it does. Pretty much anything that we can stick into this. And in fact, they do mass spec not only with molecules, but they do mass spec with elements as well. This is, you know, you ever wonder where we get the masses on the periodic table? How do we determine what the mass on the periodic table is? The way that they do the masses on the periodic table is with what's called inductively coupled plasma mass spectrometry. And they take the element sample itself, whatever it is, it could be a molecule as well. The molecule is injected into the instrument and it is shot into a plasma where once it goes into the plasma, all the electrons are stripped off of the thing. That's what a plasma essentially is the ions that are created by the loss of all of the electrons. Within that plasma, the molecule completely degrades into its residual elements. The elements then fly through the magnetic field and hit the detector, and we can tell the masses of every individual element and each isotopic mass and the relative isotopic distribution for each element that was in that sample. And so that's how we can get those masses of the periodic table as well, is that we take samples of elements and samples of molecules, and we measure their elemental distribution, their relative percent abundance as we're finding them within nature. And I've got some really cool stories about that as well. This has, I'm looking at BB as well, because this has huge implications in art. We use this in art all the time in terms of analyzing paints, analyzing samples, telling the age of things. There's all sorts of implications that are within this. And to be able to identify where materials come from, that it turns out that the different isotopic distributions of elements changes across Earth. And so if you take a particular sample of a paint or something, and we measure the distribution of the isotopes within that, we can actually tell what area or what region of the world that paint came from, or the, at least where the material, the raw material was taken from in order to make that paint. So all kinds of cool stories about that. I'm going to stop for a second to tell one of my favorite stories about that, because it's mass spec is so powerful in the number of things that you can do with it. In California, one of the problems that we had with the California condors was, you know, everybody knows that the California condor is an endangered species. Not many people know exactly why the California condor is an endangered species. The condors are a type of vulture and they exist on dead game. And when hunters in California oftentimes kill an animal, because of the terrain in which they're hunting, sometimes they can't recover that animal. And when they can't recover it, the first thing that finds it generally are the California condors. And when they go and they eat that animal, they go for the soft bits. They don't go for the rough parts. They go for the open access areas, the wounds, the bullet wounds, essentially, where the animal was shot. And they wind up eating a lot of the bullet fragments. And in eating the bullet fragments, the lead poisoning kills the condors. And the hunters were up in rage that we wanted to ban lead ammunition within California to try to protect the California condors, because they said there's no way that you can prove that a condor is dying from lead. And even if you did prove that a condor was dying from lead, you couldn't prove that it was a bullet that was killing the California condor. The scientists said, well, hold my beer. So what they do is they go out and they find the dead California condors, they find the dead birds, and they take feather clippings from the birds. They take those feather clippings and they go back and they do inductively coupled plasma mass spectrometry on the feathers. They can actually measure the lead content within the feathers. They can show that the feathers have an elevated lead content. Okay, that's great, but how can you tell that it was actually a bullet that killed that bird? Well, what this scientists did is they went over the range of that California condor in the area where they found the dead bird, and they looked at all the carcasses that they could find that were left by hunters, and they sampled the lead, the bullets, from those animals that were shot. And then they took the lead and went and did inductively coupled plasma mass spectrometry on the bullets. They developed a profile that you could actually measure and tell the lot that the bullet came from, just from a fragment of the bullet. We could tell what company manufactured it, where it was manufactured in the world, and you could even tell what lot it came from by analyzing other bullets. You could get that specific. So that they could tell by the profile of the lead isotopes, because when you look at lead, this is really cool. When you look at lead and how many isotopes lead has, let me stop the screen share for a second as I'm rambling in with these stories and just telling you how cool mass spectrometry is. Where's my application? It's hiding from me. One second, there it is. Okay, let me screen share my second screen. Okay, so what I've got up here on the screen is an application that is, hang on a second. Stop. Stop screen share. Let me screen share this. Having issues. All right, screen share. On this. And let's see if it brings me up periodic table. No, too complicated. Okay, so I just have to kill a bunch of things that I have in the background because I can't screen share just a specific window that I want. Okay, what I'm trying to show you is that when I go to lead PV, that it's polonium PV. Here's lead. Lead has four different naturally occurring isotopes of the lead. There's lead 204, lead 206, lead 207, lead 208. And they're not in minuscule amounts. 204 is only 1.4%, but 206 is 24, 207 is 22, 208 is 52%. These percentages change depending upon where you are in the world and where the lead is mined from. And it's so specific that you can tell the region that the lead is mined from just by the profile of these four isotopes. And so what they were able to do was to collect the lead bullets from all of these carcasses. They were able to measure those lead isotopes and to be able to tell where the bullets came from. And they were able to match them in the feathers. They were able to actually show what carcass it was that individual birds were eating from and which carcass actually killed the bird and which lead it was that contaminated the bird. And they were able to show that that lead was different than lead that was within the environment and that it was not just environmental lead that was killing the birds, but it was actually bullet fragments that was within these animals that were killing the birds. So it's quite impressive when you look at what mass spectrometry can do and the number of applications that it has across many, many different fields within biology, within chemistry, within art. There's just an endless array of things that we can do with mass spectrometry. Okay, Keegan, do you have a general idea of the minimum concentration required in a substance for it to be detected, tested, mass spec? Yeah, close to 10 to the minus 6 or more. I mean, we're talking nanomolar micromolar for 10 to the minus 6. But I know that they can get even smaller, that my information is slightly outdated and that new instruments can probably get down to 10 to the minus 9 or even probably 10 to the minus 12. So crazy small concentrations they can deal with. Okay, so there's my story, there's my interest and my hook in this. Let's go ahead and go back to the iPad and I'll keep going with the stories. Okay, So the fragmentations are important because the fragmentations can be measured, their masses can be measured with the same precision with which we're measuring the molecular ion. That these guys, as these charged fragments, as these charged fragments pass through the instrument, they curve as well. And they have a mass to charge ratio that can be observed. This one would be, I don't know if I have it written down, 43. I don't have its high res written down, but 43, it is C2 H3O plus. And when we calculate the when we calculate the mass to charge ratio, we do it monoisotopically. So usually when we figure out the mass of carbon, we would say that the mass of carbon is 12.0114. We would say that the mass of hydrogen is 1.00794. We would say the mass of oxygen is 15.9994. Those are the average isotopic masses for a carbon, a hydrogen, and an oxygen. But when we want to go through and we want to calculate mass to charge ratio, we do it monoisotopically, meaning that what we would do is we would say carbon equals 12, hydrogen equals 1, oxygen equals 16. And so we have times 2, which is taking us to the 24. We have times 3, which is 3. We have times 1. And so here what we've got is 43 is the sum as we add these up, and that is our mass to charge ratio. So we do it with the most prevalent of the isotopes. And we do it monoisotopically, which means that the math that we're going to be doing here is very simple, that we're not even calculating these as we would within Chem1B or Chem1A. We're just doing it monoisotopically. All right, that's a homolytic cleavage. Let me show you a heterolytic cleavage. So in a heterolytic cleavage, what happens, and I'll do it from the same molecule. We start with a molecular ion. And in this case, we wind up cleaving the bond, and I'll draw the CH3 group in here. But when we do it this time, we take both electrons and we throw both electrons this direction. And in throwing both electrons that direction, I can't do it from this resonance contributor. I have to show you how to actually get to the resonance contributor first. Let's do it this way first. Let's take this and let's look at a resonance contributor of this structure, where the free radical resides on the carbon instead of the oxygen. Okay, we're still in the same radical cation, but this is a resonance contributor for that radical cation. Now that I've resolved the issue with the electrons on the oxygen, now what I can do is I can take and I can split this and I can dump the two electrons into that bond. And now I can show the fragmentation that what we get is we get the free radical, the oxygen. Now I'm not over the number of electrons on my oxygen following my octet rule, which is a really, really important concept there. And the CH3 group, having lost both electrons, now is the cation. And so this is the neutral radical. This is the fragment, the charged fragment. this charge fragment has a mass to charge ratio equal to 15. And it has a formula of CH3 with a positive charge. So there's a heterolytic cleavage. So the heterolytic cleavage is oftentimes we have to go through a resonance contributor in order to be able to show that heterolytic cleavage and how it happens. Okay.
You can only measure the charged fragment.
And in fact, I was trying to figure out where I wanted to deal with that. And since you brought it up, this is now the perfect time to deal with it. Only the charged fragment is observable. So what happens is that when there's a fragmentation that occurs within the mass spec instrument, so you have your sample ionization. Sample goes in. We have the electrospray that comes in and knocks an electron off of this thing. We get the molecular ion. The molecular ion can fragment, can break. And as that molecular ion breaks, what we end up with is the fragment, which is charged. And we end up, let's call that fragment A. And we end up with fragment B, which is neutral. So now what happens is, as these guys are passing through the magnet, remember that the detector sits down here and the magnets sit here. So as fragment A goes through the magnets, it bows and hits the detector. But as fragment B goes through the magnets, B is neutral and B does not hit the detector. B just winds up going through the instrument and passes through the instrument without ever hitting the detector. So we refer to B as the loss. Is how B is referred to. And fragment A is referred to as the observable. So things which are neutral are called the loss. And things which are observable that have a charge are called observable. And so going back, if we look back at our patterns back here, and I had the charged ion with its mass to charge ratio, this is my observable. And the other guy, which is the neutral free radical, this is my loss. Same thing down here. The neutral radical would be the loss. And the charged methyl cation would be the observable. In terms of fragmentation. So is ESI always preferred? ESI is the electrospray ionization, and ESI is preferred for certain types of molecules. Let's talk about the difference in the two types of molecules. So ESI is preferred when you have things. This is our electrospray. ESI is preferred when you have large molecules, like proteins. It depends on having structures like this. Where you have a lot of oxygens and nitrogens in terms of, and the different R groups that can come off of these guys as amino acids. These guys here can all be protonated because of the oxygen lone pairs. And because we can do protonations both on oxygen lone pairs and the possibility of protonating the nitrogens as well, that these types of molecules are very amenable to electrosprite ionization. They're easy to protonate. Molecules which are easy to protonate, things which are more polar in nature. So we can think about maybe smaller molecules that may be ester-like. These molecules can also be protonated and are good suited or well-suited for electrosprite ionization because of their ability to be protonated. But when you have molecules that can't be protonated, we would prefer electron impact. For small molecules and nonpolar. Why nonpolar? Because these nonpolar molecules let me throw in one more double bond in there. These molecules can have an electron knocked off of them. They're not easy to protonate. So first off, if I try to protonate it, you get no reaction, which means you won't see anything come through the detector if you try to protonate it. But if we take and we do electrospray and we knock an electron off the system, we can knock an electron off. So this would be ESI, electrospray ionization. This would be EI, electron impact. And what I get here is I knock an electron off the system and I create the radical cation. And it's easier to do with nonpolar types of things. So it's not that ESI is always preferred. In fact, ESI is not preferred over EI. It is only preferred for certain molecules as to whether or not you want to do electrosprite ionization or whether you want to do electron impact. Because of what we do in this class, because of our curriculum, which is small molecule, not mostly biological, but small molecule more towards straight up organic chemistry, we tend to deal only with electron impact and not with the electrosprite ionization. Techniques are the same in terms of the way that you deal with the structures and the way that you deal with fragmentations. It is almost identical. Fragmentations may be a little bit different with the electrospray ionization, but we're going to focus, this is going to be our focus. Our focus is going to be exclusively electron impact. Okay. All right. What do I want to show you? I want to show you some calculators. And some differences between molecules. Let's look at two molecules. Let's look at acetone and butane. So let's title this Power of High resolution data. Let's say that I have a molecular ion that I measure that has a charge to mass ratio, MZ ratio, equal to 58. So the molecular ion is measured at 58. And I want to know what is the formula. I want to know the molecular formula. There's a couple of different ways that I can find the molecular formula. One way to find the molecular formula is to use what's called the rule of 13. This is a hand method of finding it. I'm going to show you a computational way of finding it as well. So we're going to go through a couple of different ways, but I'm going to use this as an example of how we can figure out what the molecular formula is. We've taken an unknown sample. The unknown sample is injected into the mass spectrometer, and we get an MC ratio of 58 for the molecular ion, and we want to know what the molecular formula is for that 58. So the rule of 13, what the rule of 13 is that most carbons or most organic molecules have at least one carbon and one hydrogen in a ratio of 1:1. And if I take 12 plus 1, that equals 13. So what I can do is I can take the 58 and I can divide it by 13. And what I'm finding is the number of carbon and hydrogen units within that formula. Does that make sense? So that if I look at the number of times that 13 divides into 58, that number will tell me how many C's and H's there are in a 1:1 ratio within the molecule. So 58 divided by 13 is 4. And then that 4 is going to give me 52. And I will get 6. And then I would have to bring down a 0, and I would have to go through and keep doing the long division, but we're not going to do long division. This is enough to be able to get me where I want, because this is 4 with a remainder of 6. You have gone all the way through college calculus and probably differential equations, only to go back to preschool and remainder of 6. When was the last time you ever saw a remainder punched out on a long division? Okay, so what this means is that the formula is C4H4, and the remainder of 6 that is here, this 6 we take and we add to the number of hydrogens, because it is 6 single units, 6 ones, and hydrogen weighs 1 gram per mole. And so I'm taking the remaining 6 units and applying them to the hydrogens, which means that my overall formula is actually C4H10. That is one possible formula. And if you calculate now the molecular mass of C4H10, it comes out to, well, let's make sure that I show where I put all these other things. So this was the number of units, C4H4, the way that it's coming together. Okay, so if I look at 4 times 12, which is 48, plus 10, 58. It checks out and it gives you back the correct molecular formula. But this isn't the only molecular formula that can fit, because I can derive equivalent molecular formulas if I use substitution as a way of introducing new elements. For instance, if I want to introduce an oxygen, which equals 16 grams per mole, is equivalent to a carbon, which is 12, plus another 4, which also equals 16 grams per mole. So that means that an oxygen is equal to 1 carbon and 4 hydrogens. So I can use, by substitution, I can go through and I can say C4H10 is equivalent to taking away 1 carbon and 4 hydrogens, C3H6, with an oxygen, which is equivalent to what I lost. So what I did is I took away a CH4 and I added an oxygen, because these two are equal to each other. And so if I calculate the mass of C3H6O, it's going to be 58 as well. And so I can't tell the difference with a mass to charge ratio of 58. I can't tell the difference between C4H10, butane, and C3H6O, acetone, on a low-res instrument. So possible formulas. Include C4H10, C3H6O. I could do that again. I could say C2H2O2. That's another possible formula. And I can substitute not only oxygens, but I could substitute other elements as well. If I calculate their carbon hydrogen equivalents. So I could come up with a carbon hydrogen equivalent of nitrogen or sulfur or chlorine or fluorine. And I could put those elements in as well and come up with equivalent formulas, all of which are going to be 58 grams per mole. Does that make sense so far in terms of how I'm getting these formulas, where they're coming from? Okay, but let's say that I had high-res data. Let's say that the resolution that I have is that with high-res data, instead of a molecular ion that was 58, what I got was 58.07825. Now, how can I figure out what the formula actually is? Well, this is where we turn to a mass spec calculator, of which there are many online. Let me stop share and show you one that I like to use. So I'm going to keep going with my application here, which is IMAS. And IMAS has in it tools, has a mass to sum and a composition to sum. And I think I want to go to mass to sum. And I want to tell it that this is 58.07825. I'm not sure. Are you guys able to see what I'm doing here? Okay, cool. I'm going to tell it that it's a deviation that may be as small as, this is an absolute deviation, so I'm in my last, maybe I'm going to do it 0.0001. It's something else. It has a minimum number of two carbons, but maybe it's got as many as 10. It has a minimum number of hydrogens as one, but maybe it's got as many as 20, I don't know. May not have any nitrogens, but it could have like four. May not have any oxygens, but maybe it's got up to like four. And we'll throw sulfur in there too. Maybe it's got two sulfurs in there, something like that. And I say, what is it? And it comes up with C4H10. It comes up with 58.078250. And that only that formula fits those isotopes, because what it's doing now is it's using every isotopic mass, and it's using the exact isotopic masses of carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, sulfur, nitrogen to find out combinations that give me that formula. Let me change the absolute resolution up here. Let me make it 0.01. No, maybe I need to make it 0.1. Just showing you how specific. Okay, so there. When I say that maybe my uncertainty is in the tens place, all of a sudden, all these other formulas become viable. And you can see how small the differences are in their molar masses, all of them being 58 grams per mole, But each one of these, because of the different isotopes involved in the mass itself, let's see if I can do it this way. I see people trying to lean in and squint at their screen. Maybe that helps. Because these numbers are so small, but so significantly different based on the isotopes and the isotopic individual isotopic masses of each one of these elements that are going into it, we can distinguish between each one of these using high-res mass spec. And so high-res mass spec literally gives you the molecular formula by using a computer to go through a Monte Carlo approach to figure out what the actual molecular formula is. And the better the resolution is, if we have a resolution that is only a tenth and goes plus or minus a tenth, we can't really do very much. But the second you take it to a hundredth is enough of a resolution to be able to tell the molecular formula definitively and get it down to one molecular formula, which is pretty cool. So we don't do this by hand. We use computers to be able to go through and do this type of computation for us, which is really pretty cool. But we also do by hand the rule of 13 when we don't have a computer available to us. And what are we wondering how what one looks? How H18C2O works? Yeah. Many of these, that's a great question. Many of these, if I go back to that, formulas that the computer is spitting out are simply ways of taking the elements and combining them together in order to get 58 point whatever. It doesn't mean they're real molecules. And in fact, you can't make a real molecule out of that. And that's one way in which a chemist would rule out possibilities that the computer is giving them by looking at the molecular formulas and saying, these are nonsensical molecular formulas. And so things that are like 18 carbons, 18 hydrogens, one carbon, or two carbons and one oxygen just wouldn't work, just simply based on the number of hydrogens that are there in the formula. So there's some common sense that needs to be applied to the output of a computation like this as well, to filter through nonsensical molecules to find the logical ones. Okay, these are all good questions. I think that illustrates it enough. Okay, so what I need to do is I need to stop the share, bring it back into the iPad. Got a question from Keegan. So if you knew certain elements in the product came from specific isotopes, you would have to enter that in that deviation. Actually, Keegan, you would not. Interestingly enough, because what would happen is if you knew that you had certain isotopes in there, the computer can take care of that for you. Because you can have allowances for let's say that we were looking at deuterated solvents and we wanted only those things that had deuterium in it. Then we could tell the computer to look for deuterium, but we would also just include deuterium in our computation and it would come up. So that's a way to just as I was including oxygen and nitrogen and other things in my computation. And that calculator that I showed you allows me to dial that in more specifically. Many of the calculators don't give you that ability to dial it in to that degree. And you sort of use a more general calculator that also takes into account specific isotopes. Isotopes are actually a really big component of mass spec. We will spend a lot of time talking about isotopes and how to use isotopes. There's a lot of cool ways in which we both see the isotopes within mass spec and utilize isotopes in order to do mass spec. So lots of isotope work coming ahead here. All right, so what I wanted to show here was that with high resolution data and a mass spec calculator, with a deviation plus or minus 0.01 on the MZ ratio, we can get that 58.07825 5 equals C4H10. And that we can get that one molecule. If it were the C3H6O, 58.04187 would equal C, come on, C3H6O. So we could distinguish between them, easily distinguished between. So we could get the formulas. Okay. The next thing that I normally go into I'm wondering if I want to go into the alpha cleavages more. Let's see, let's check time. I got 15 minutes. Alpha cleavages are going to take more time. Let me show you some more fun things with isotopes. Let's talk isotopes for a little bit. Within isotopes, some of the most common things that we wind up looking for in mass spec is we look at halogens in particular. Halogens, when we look at bromine is a combination of bromine 79 and bromine 81. Chlorine is 35 and chlorine 37. Fluorine only has one isotope. It's fluorine 19. And iodine only has one isotope. And it is 120 something, one. Mass tools, periodic table, iodine. 127. It was 120 something. 127. And so fluorine is 100% one isotope. Iodine is 100% single isotope. They have no other isotopes of these guys that exist. But the chlorine and the fluorine are interesting in their isotopic distributions. In that bromine, when we look at it, is 78.9, the lighter isotope. And, excuse me, I did that wrong. I looked at the mass, not the isotope. It's 50.69%, the lighter isotope. And the other one is 49.3%. These are almost 50-50. Chlorine has percentages that are closer to 3 to 1. Chlorine's percentages are 75.77. And 24.23. Almost a 3 to 1 ratio of the lighter isotope. Those isotopes allow us to be able to tell when a molecule has a halogen in it because of what it does to the molecular ion. So if we imagine a molecule that has a chlorine in it, let's pick a fairly small molecule. Let's deal with CH3Cl. chloromethane. When I look at this and I look at the molecular ion peak and I knock off an electron out of it, I get CH3Cl radical cation. And essentially what I did is knocked off one of the electrons off the chlorine that gave me the radical cation. And we'll call this guy the molecular ion peak. The molecular ion peak, though, is actually two different molecular ion peaks. There's a molecular ion peak where I have a chlorine that is the chlorine 35. And I have a molecular ion peak where it's a chlorine that's 37. And they weigh different amounts. The mass to charge ratio is different for each one of these. So calculating the mass to charge ratio for this guy, it's going to be equal to 12 plus 3 plus 35 as I add all those guys up. So 40, 50. So this is going to be equal to 50. And the mass to charge ratio over here, this is going to be equal to 12 plus 3 plus 37, which is going to be equal to 52. Two mass units higher than the other one. And relative abundance wise, this one on the left, this is three times more likely. So what I see is in the mass to charge ratio readout on the mass spec, what I see is a peak. This peak's actually a little bit shorter than this 3-to-1 ratio. So this is 50 on my mass to charge ratio. This is 50 and this is 52. And these are both molecular ion peaks. But one of them is the molecular ion where this is the molecular ion with chlorine 37. And this one is the molecular ion with chlorine 35. And I can actually see two different molecular ion peaks because of what happens with the isotope. Not only that, I can distinguish that from a situation where I might have a bromine in a molecule. Let's take a look at the bromine situation and how that would look different. Okay, assume average was 50.5. Actually, we don't average it. That's what's interesting, is that there's no average that's here. That when you do mass spec, we don't average any of the data. That in mass spec, what we're getting is actual isotopics masses, and we can see them all individually, and we can measure their isotopic percentage. We can measure how many are hitting the detector and their relative heights. And so what we see here is an intensity that we would set this one here at 100. This is relative intensity. We always set the highest peak at 100. So relative intensity. And then down here, this one would show up close to like 33, one third of the tallest peak. And so we don't assume an average. We don't even need to average it out. There are just two molecular ion peaks, one at 50 and one at 52. And that tells us that we're dealing with a chlorine, with a molecule that has a chlorine in it. All right, so I want to do this bromine example. Let's do the same thing. CH3 with a bromine, which is 79. And CH3 bromine, which is 81. So the MZ ratio for these are going to be 12 plus 3 plus 79. So I'm going to get 94 for this one. And because it's two units difference, this MZ ratio is going to be 96. It'll be 12 plus 3 plus 81. But the difference when I look at the spectrum is that when I look at the mass to charge ratios, I'm going to get a peak. I sort of want to line these up with it. I'm going to get a peak that is going to be here at 94. And I'm going to get a peak, which is going to be here at 96. And these are both molecular ion peaks. It's just that this one is the molecular ion with a bromine 79. And the other one is a molecular ion with a bromine, which is 81. And they're in about 50-50 ratios in terms of their relative height. And so it allows me to be able to look at a molecule and tell if a molecule has a chlorine in it or if a molecule has a bromine in it, simply by looking at the molecular ion peak and where the molecular ion peak is. Okay. All right, so some things about mass spec. So we've gone through some isotope things, and I'm closing out in time here. I just want to look at sort of a standard mass spec spectrum and outline some of the terminology in the way that we look at it, okay? And then show you some place where you can go for some further information. We'll do a lot more in lecture, but also some place where you can start practicing now, because you've got enough to even start doing some practice. Okay, mass spectrometry. When we look at a spectrum, the spectrums usually take on this sort of appearance. This is the MZ ratio. We have the relative abundance. We have the molecular ion peak, which is usually, so we start off at zero and we increase in terms of our mass to charge ratio. So that's increasing mass charge ratio. The tallest peak, not the tallest, the farthest to the right, the peak that is the farthest to the right is always defined as the molecular ion peak. So the molecular ion peak is the highest MZ ratio. Let's say it that way. The peak that is the tallest peak, the highest relative abundance, this peak is what is called the base peak. The base peak is what is the most common fragmentation pattern. So usually what we do is we take an arrow and we draw an arrow over to this peak. This represents a fragmentation. This would be the observable. The difference between the observable and the molecular ion would be considered to be the loss. And so the arrow sort of represents the loss. There are other fragmentations which can occur within a structure. those fragmentations can occur from the molecular ion peak, but they can also equally occur from any peak upfield of them. So they don't all have to occur from the molecular ion. Sometimes when things start fragmenting, they can fragment multiple times as they degrade in the spectrophotometer in the time that they are traveling to the detector. So really, the only things that we're super concerned with is we're concerned with this molecular ion peak, which is our highest mass to Z ratio. And we're also oftentimes very concerned with this base peak, because the base peak is telling me the most common fragmentation pattern. And that is our tallest peak. And that peak is always set at 100. And so the scale always extends from 100 to zero, with the base peak being 100. The base peak can also be the molecular ion peak. They can be one and the same. So it's possible to be able to have a pattern where my tallest peak is out here and everything else is short. And this is the molecular ion peak and also the base peak. And when that happens, it generally happens for a certain class of molecules, molecules that don't like to fragment, molecules that are super stable. Think about the most stable type of molecules that you know of. What do we know of molecules that have a certain special type of stability that we haven't seen any reactions with yet? Noble gases, yeah, noble gases are good. Good leaving groups is what Keegan's saying. Noble gases aren't what I'm thinking about there, because I'm thinking about actual organic molecules, a molecule that expresses a certain type of stability. What are PGSs? I don't know what PGSs are.
Protecting groups?
I'm not quite thinking protecting groups. Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen a reaction with a benzene ring? Has the benzene ring ever done anything? Has it reacted in any way? Not yet. Why not? What is it about a benzene ring that's special? Resonance, close. It's not resonance in a way, but it's more than resonance. I know we haven't discussed it yet. We haven't really talked about it. Aromaticity, aromatic molecules. Aromaticity is different than resonance. We need to explain why aromaticity is so important, but aromatic molecules, and benzene is not the only aromatic molecule. There are many other molecules which are aromatic. Aromatic molecules are so stable that they tend not to fragment. And they tend so much not to fragment that when they go through a spectrophotometer like this, because they don't fragment, their molecular ion peak is always their tallest peak, or usually almost always their tallest peak. And therefore, when you see a base peak that is also the molecular ion peak, it's always a good idea to assume that that molecule is aromatic. It tells you something about the molecule, about how stable it is. Okay, lots of good stuff here. The only other thing that I wanted to show you real quick was a website and a tutorial. So this is off of my website, chemed.study. Again, through the additional resources tab, down here at the very bottom, I have introduction to mass spectrometry. This takes you to a site that says the University of Arizona. And the University of Arizona has asked me to change that because it is no longer at the University of Arizona. I stole it. The woman who wrote this, her name is Linda Breachy. Linda Breachy is now a retired professor from the University of Arizona. And this website was one of the best tutorials that I have used for 20 years. And she made an outstanding resource here. It has gone down twice since the 20 years. And since Linda retired, they completely took it down and weren't going to put it back up. And so I contacted Linda and I said, Linda, can I please revive your website? And I'll host it on my own site. And I'll give you all the attributions and we'll put the University of Arizona up there and I'll make it available not only to my students, but everybody. And she said, yes, please do it. So I used the Internet Wayback Machine and I found all of the images and I put this whole thing back together and redid it from scratch. So it's beautiful. It has a great introduction on how mass spec works. This is a great just introduction to read in terms of how it works and definitions and the common isotopes that we see, the ionization methods that are here. She just did a beautiful job of putting this all together. Okay, don't use the links at the bottom. I'm sure the links don't work. I haven't tried this. I gotta ditch the links. But everything else consistent internal to the website works and is fantastic. In addition, she has examples of each type of functional group and what you look for in the functional group. So aldehydes, alcohols, alkanes, and what is typical of each one of these functional groups to look for. And then after seeing what is typical of each one of them, then she has a quiz. And so you can go and you can do the alcohol quiz. We'll spend time doing this on Thursday. I'll go through it with you and we'll do a lot of examples of different functional groups, which is really quite fun. You can click on the spectrum to get a larger spectrum so that you can see it more clearly. You can go back. You can get a hint of which it will tell you what to look for in the spectrum. And then when you click on an answer, it tells you why it's wrong. It doesn't just tell you that it's wrong. It tells you why it's wrong. And if it's correct, why it's correct. So there's a lot of good things that's helpful here. Yes, it can feel overwhelming, but like I said, I'm going to go through it with you. I just wanted to show you where this resource is and that I have a super resource available for mass spec. And we'll go over it together and it won't be so overwhelming. We'll make it more palatable. If you do anything, I would say go through and just look at the introduction and read through the introduction and that can be helpful all on its own. And that shouldn't be so overwhelming. But you know, NMR was overwhelming when we started it too. And you guys are getting much, much better at that. Although BB may profess to be still overwhelmed. So I saw that face you were making. Okay, let me open up for questions. And I know I went a little bit over time there, but I wanted to give you sort of those resources and show you where they are. I'm happy to stick around for questions for a bit. There's lots more to come on this. You know, I never dump you on your own. I always take lots of time in lab to go over some of these things as well. So we get plenty of work time. And we'll continue on that path. I was trying to say that process. I'm not going to switch gears on you guys here at the last minute. Okay. So that's everything I had for today. Let me stop the share. Let me stop the recording. And I'm happy to open it up and entertain any questions you guys have.